before we kind of get into opening the floor to questions, please go to our link tree, visit our merchandise. The merchandise is nice. It's been out since the beginning of the month. So, and thank you if you already bought some stuff. So please go patronize our little shop. And then also, if you are a white person or identify as white, this is primarily more for you. With that reparations of, well, for reparations purposes, please hit us with the Venmo or the Cash App ASAP. You know, so, you know, and if you cannot do that, please send to your other white friends, because this is something we love to do, but we do it for free. But this comes at labor for us, but we do it for the people. So thank you for that. And also, I don't want to say too much about what drives us to do melanated social work, but I just want to maybe have my brothers talk about what drives them to do social work or melanated social work.
I would just say, you know, I think melanated social work definitely like helped me, like these folks before we were melanated social work helped me get through grad school. And so I definitely think in going and pursuing a social work degree for either folks that haven't or who are just finishing up school, I think like that was integral to me just surviving grad school, but also just like being able to learn. Because I think we all walked away from that experience feeling like there were things that we learned, but there were definitely like gaps in the education that we were provided. And that particularly just because like the institution that we went to was a white supremacist institution, was not meant for like the healing and liberation of Black and brown people. And so I think there was learning that we were doing amongst each other, and we've tried to keep that learning going as we've exited from grad school. And so, you know, we just thought, just considering the current moment with COVID, like this has got to be one of like just the most stressful time to graduate from school, to pursue school. And so we just thought it'd be cool to have this platform to offer any insight or knowledge in terms of what our experience was like in grad school or exiting grad school, to hopefully continue to build that knowledge base and pass some of those things on.
Thanks. This is a super dope community that we have right here, coast to coast. And hopefully we can like share knowledge and just help all of us progress, if not just feel connected.
Yeah. I don't know. Do y'all feel good? Like, should we pivot into questions now?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
But Mike, you're going to start to talk about foster care.
Yeah, I was just bringing up a theme I heard from a few folks who had mentioned that they were interested in this environment, but felt conflicted about it.
Yeah. So folks, feel free, you know what I mean? If you want to unmute yourself, you can offer a question up to the space. If you prefer, you can also just enter questions into the chat. That's totally cool too. But whatever folks feel most comfortable with.
I guess like knowing that I have to go into like being a child welfare social worker for 2 years after I graduate from Cal, especially like since I work at a DMH like contracted agency currently, I already see like a lot of issues with billing, and how people are just kind of like seen as like per capita rather than actual people who need help. And so I think like there's like a moral value system in me that like tends to have like an internal conflict. But then again, it's like, it might just be my agency, or I don't know if it's like a general like view.
I mean, I definitely think it's a conflict in the work. I've never worked as a child welfare worker. I feel like in my work though, I partner a lot with a lot of child welfare workers, and know some folks personally that work within child welfare here in Alameda County that are like exceptional folks, but I've also had my fair share of folks that just like hate the work that they do. And even in my work as a therapist, I'm contracted by the county. So all of like the work that I do is through like Medi-Cal billable notes. And it does, like, I think there is like certain ways in which like doing that work and having to like justify your service. There are pieces of that feel like compromises to my own values and what I think is important in the work, because the ways in which like the county might want me to justify or bill for the work may not be like what I think is most important in the work. But it's almost just become like this necessity of the work, because it's like how I receive my salary, and I'd like to continue to have a job and be there and do therapy with folks. And it's almost something that like I just turn off, and like I just like do the notes without really even thinking about it. But it is like essential to the work. And so I think like figuring out like where you end up and what that looks like, I think can be very different, because I think what usually lends to like folks burnout within the field is not usually connected to the actual therapeutic work and being connected to the families and being immersed in community. It's like all the paperwork shit. Like that's the shit that leads to burnout. And so I think it's really important, like as you're entering into a workspace, and just like having a better understanding of like what the documentation requirements are that they're expecting you to do. Because the reality is, at a certain point, you're going to start to jeopardize like the level and quality of the work that you can offer if like their expectation for billing or documentation is like unreasonable. And I think like a lot of us end up in spaces that are looking to like capitalize on like our intentions of being caring individuals. And sometimes like those organizations or these like county institutions, like they can be extremely exploitative of that if we let them.
Thanks.
Yeah. Y'all had anything to add to that?
I'll say, as far as adding to that, like, just examine and see where your energy is right now with those morals, because, you know, you get years and years into being a social worker, and there's people who may lose that level of integrity and care. So just notice where that is now. And one of my biggest pieces of advice, and I'll probably say it later, is to just remember who you are. Take your mental health days. Be rooted in a community with people with similar ideas and similar vibes. Like the way Melanie and Social Worker and I, we all sit together, it's good to be connected to that community. And also, if you're able to seek out a therapist, and I say this for everybody, because as therapists and social workers, we need people to support us and help us heal through our personal stuff, but also the secondary trauma of being there for other people. So just go with that same integrity and the energy you have now, and just see where it is when you're 5 years in.
For sure. Someone wrote in the comments section in the chat, someone said, how did you decide your specialization?
Ooh, I learned mine with time. Working in a residential program, I was working with 13 to 15 year olds. And then when I was working in a middle school with eighth graders, that was tough. Eighth graders are jerks. And I realized when I was working in foster care and adoption, I had a caseload from a newborn to a 20-year-old that I felt more connected, I could do more meaningful work with the older adults that I worked with. So my transition to like college mental health, like essentially was more fluid in how I went about the work, but it definitely took time. Like this is my fifth therapeutic space where I'm doing the work. And so part of it is just kind of learning what you like and what you don't like.
I think for me it was, I don't even know if I still actually think I have a specialization, honestly. I'm a trauma therapist. I mean, and that just kind of is what it is. And so I can work with folks that have anxiety or depression or PTSD or trouble with their identity, or, you know, a lot of different things. And so my Khalida likes to say, like, your specialty is like Black men's issues. And I'm like, oh yeah, but also no, like there are other things too. And so I really just say, stick to what you like. Try some things out. If you know you don't like kids, don't work with kids. If you know you don't like, you know, adults, don't work with adults. If you do research and kind of feel out and for a lot of folks, you can kind of feel out in your internships what you like and what you don't if you've been through them already. But I think just take every experience as a learning experience, and you might have an internship and be like, you know what, I did not like that shit at all. And so now you know you don't like it. But you can still take skills, you can still take individuals that you met to network with, you can still take a lot from those experiences. But I think it's really about what drives you. Like, what are you passionate about? What can you see yourself doing for, you know, a little while? And is it, like, do you have capacity for it? So I think it's up to you, and it kind of calls you, I think.
Absolutely.
I want to jump in real quick. I'm sorry, Josh, because Marvin, you reminded me that specialization wasn't just like the age group of people I'm working with, but like a more specific modality. And you were already naming it. But I think that when you go about the work and you're learning something that's like been evidence-based and is really clinical, my specialty is not necessarily something that is clinical. And it's I went a fellowship program that is psychodynamic therapy. And I like that because it's sort of this all-encompassing, holistic sort of view of a person. And you get to take into consideration like past events and attachments and how they tell their story with narrative therapy. Like, you can incorporate different types of modalities, but like, I'm not necessarily the most clinical person you'll ever meet in the therapeutic space. And I wholeheartedly, like, I'm okay with that. Clinical interventions like work better than like trying to like be by the book with a client. But I just wanted to name that because that's something that I have also learned along the way.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I've always just worked with kids. Like, I draw so much life from working with young people. And I think schools are a particularly interesting place to do work because I think a lot of kids experience trauma in schools and a lot of trauma gets acted out in schools. And so, yeah, I think there's probably part of me that's like, I'm drawn to it as some type of like reparative experience and like my own dislike for school, especially considering that I work at the high school that I graduated from, which was not my intention at all. It just kind of worked out that way. But yeah, so like I've always known I wanted to work with kids. I know that I do that now, but I also acknowledge that I may not always have the level of energy and patience that it requires to work with young people. And so I don't want to work with adults right now, but it's always a possibility. And so I try to just remind myself that I can like stay flexible in the work that I do and not feel like I am like limiting the amount of possibilities or that I continue to do something if I'm like no longer drawing any type of like life or pleasure from it. In terms of like my modalities, I was just always really drawn to narrative therapy. As soon as it was introduced to me, I took a solution focused course when I was at Boston College School of Social Work. And the solution focused therapist was really adamant about connecting me to some folks that were narrative practitioners. And I just like naturally gravitated to the model because I think like at its base, like us doing therapeutic work, we are supporting people in telling their stories and holding their stories and helping them reframe their stories. And just thinking about like going back, like the ancestral practice of like sharing stories and like, what does that mean in terms of like understanding our own ancestral experience and things of that nature. And it's one of the only models that I've ever worked within that explicitly discusses like systems of oppression and how does that play into a part in terms of someone's experience of like a mental health diagnosis and how do those things like occur living in an oppressive world, and that those are things that we openly share and talk about in the therapeutic space. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to hop back in and talk about modalities. I didn't speak on that. I use a variety of different things. I'm not like a one, you know, modality, one technique therapist. My clients that in consultations is that like, I won't do just CBT. I won't do just solution focused. I won't just do narrative. It's a combination of everything. So I want to make sure that I'm going to do the best for my clients and what they need. And so that's just my style. That's what I do. But if you feel like you vibe with one modality over another, then definitely do it.
I was going to say, as far as me getting into the work, I mean, to be honest, a lot of it for me, I guess it has a similar, somebody else said, it's in your calling. And I think a big thing with me is not having my father around ever in my life. So that longing from older males, and then getting in a lot of different, from being an RA in college to being a day camp counselor overseas for a few years, I noticed that I could really have an influence with youth. And also, young men that, look like me, and all young people, but predominantly black and brown young people, I'm still relatively young, but especially back then, I was basically their same age or very close to their age. So having that nearness and being able to, be a RA, be a day camp counselor, do Mike or Marvin didn't say it yet, but we actually both, not together, we did in separate cities, but I did City of Boston, he did City of Miami. And then also after that, going and being the city, the school that I did my first year in City Year was where I did my internship at for school social work, to go into a day program outpatient for children and adolescents, to being, working with youth and young adults in New York City. So I get all these experiences, and now, I've been blessed to I still work with youth, but pardon me, working with more adults. And I think now I work more with adults, predominantly African-American and black males and other men of color that have been, gunshot survivors, stab survivors, or secondary witnesses, or people who have been impacted by secondary violence in the community. So all these different experiences, like with a social work degree, especially when you get that, I'm not there yet with my independent license like Jesse, there's so many different opportunities and ways to be like, oh, this is cool, this isn't cool. And I went and I did a immigration lab in Italy, and I was realizing they have all these systems, and it's cool to do the noble work overseas. For people that look like me, we can take all these same people with degrees and licenses and money and all these things, and I can have it for, today's Tamir Rice's birthday. So the Tamir Rice's of the world, the Tony McDay's of the world, all those young people who look, are the kids that are in Roxbury and Dorchester, that's in Boston, or the kids that are in Brooklyn, Brownsville, Brooklyn, whew, at that, or the kids in East Harlem, that's what I do it for. And, when it's your calling, I don't know it's my calling, you just step into it and get opportunity after opportunity, see what's good for you, see what's not, and you just keep rolling with that. So, I'm just blessed by the creator to be able to have these opportunities and have a great support system. And Ashley, my partner, she has an LICSW, and these fellas right here.
For sure. Chanel wrote in the chat wanting to hear about barriers that you've experienced as black social workers. And maybe to add to that, what is some things that y'all have done to sustain yourself in going through that?
Say barriers. I think I'm stuck on that word. What do you mean by barriers?
I mean,
like challenges.
Yeah, barriers is challenges. Yeah.
Okay. I think just not being taken seriously. I think not getting the same respect as another social worker who is a white woman. I think that I get questioned a lot about, or I was questioned a lot about, why I was doing a certain thing, or even what I was doing with my time, as if I was kind of just, doing nothing, watching YouTube or whatever. I think another challenge or barrier is how to advocate passionately without coming off as the angry black man. I literally had somebody in the school district when I sat down in a meeting who we just disagreed. I wasn't even yelling. It was like the same tone I'm using right now. And she went to my supervisor and said, Marvin came off angry in that meeting. I think this is something that you need to work on with him. And so, you know, when you're seen as, first of all, I think a lot of us are already trying to come off as the most respectful and articulate and, you know, coming off as if we deserve to be in this space and not sometimes not being our authentic selves. Now, without doing for just existing, there's already these character traits that are given to me without my knowledge, because I'm just like basically because of the color of my skin. And so, you know, I think for a lot of those instances, like some of them we have control over and some of them we don't. And the ones that we have control over, I think we should definitely take action. I think we should definitely, so the woman that called me angry in the meeting, I told my supervisor, I told Khalida who I was working with, and they were both like, yeah, set up a meeting with her and let's talk about it. The woman like dodged me and then later left the school district, but just creating that space to be able to say, okay, you said I was angry, explain yourself first of all, and then also let me tell you why that's problematic and the historical context behind it. And maybe in your role you may not have that level of confidence because maybe it's, you know, there are power dynamics at play, there are different things at play. And so I think that having a supervisor or having colleagues as allies, as people that you can trust and speak to authentically is very helpful. Because, you know, if at that point I was just a social worker going up against like the deputy chief of something, and it's just like, I ain't got no power in that situation. And so without my immediate supervisor helping me out, without, you know, other social workers on my level that would have, you know, backed me, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, have that confidence to advocate for myself. But I definitely think that where you can challenge things, definitely challenge them. There are some times where, like, you know, I was accompanying folks to court or to doctor's appointments, and you're seen as literally everything but the social worker. When I was at court, people were thought that I was waiting for my time to meet with the judge. And so, like, those things we don't really have control over. So, I mean, as much as I can, I use this platform and use the podcast and Instagram Lives to talk about this and to educate white folks and the folks that really had those assumptions about me and those stereotypes and those microaggressions, and making sure that they're hyper aware of their words and their language, because many folks are well-intentioned, but then it turns around and it's, you know, hella problematic. And so, I think advocate for yourself when you can, use allies, and do what's in your control. I think one of the hardest things is that some things are out of your control and you can't do shit about it. One of the hardest things, but you keep it pushing because it's about your clients at the end of the day.
I'll jump in briefly after Marvin, because that his experience of going into a courtroom or a courthouse and being mistaken for anybody but the professional, I've had that too. As a black social worker, I mean, as a person of color, you're going to experience racism, unfortunately. Like, that's the reality. Whether it's from your colleagues or from being with your client out in the community, like, shit's going to come up. I remember when I worked in Virginia in the foster care system, like, there were daily microaggressions that I would hear. And sometimes just like overt racism, and like traveling with the client, and like seeing Confederate flags, like in the community, like this is the reality of like where some of our clients live. And like just being a person of color in the field of social work. Marvin, you were touching on it. I thought about like, how did I survive that? Like, that was the time when we were really coming together and like formulating like melanated social work at the time. Prior to us, like having something like where it's like, we can kind of go forward with this, was like just check-ins. Like, how are y'all doing in your place of employment? What are things that are coming up? Like, can we process it? Can we offer supervision and feedback? Like, that saved me, truly, for to be able to last as long as I did in that environment. And I also want to shout out Jeremy real quick, because there's a really thoughtful post that he put in the comment section that I want to touch on with regards to, like, the foster care system. My experience in the foster care system, I think it's different working for the county in Virginia than it is in California, because I didn't have to document anything that would be quote unquote like billable. Like, I would do the work that was closely aligned with the court system. So documenting like what the client had to do for like medical care, dental care, their schooling system, talking to the guardian ad litems, talking to the attorneys, talking with the potential adoptive parents, talking with the biological parents. It was more case managerial work than it was actual like therapy. And the connection that I had with the client, although it was therapeutic, wasn't documented. So that's something to be mindful of, like going throughout like this DCF system, is that like, it's going to be kind of like crossing T's and dotting I's for people who, for the powers that be that need that. And it's less concerned with your connection with the person you're working with, and like how you're meeting goals or milestones or helping that person like survive another day. And that's the fucked up problematic stuff of like working within a system, or within that system anyway. But I would just kind of echo Marvin, to like experiencing racism and finding community is what like truly helped me feel supported and continue to like push on doing this work. Yeah.
Josh, you had anything to that you wanted to add?
As far as barriers, I think that, again, with white women, they just feel like, white people in general, they just go around thinking shit is theirs. So they want to stake a claim in social work being something that they can only do. While many times if they're in heterosexual relationships, their Brad Pitt or Ben Affleck can go be the investment banker. We're actually doing this, I feel, more so because we know why. I don't even have to explain why. So they stake a claim with them, for me, in anti-blackness, because I don't have any type of intersections that go with who, what they believe in. And I've also been a person to always stand up and stick up for myself. So I don't really, I know I get probably labeled a difficult employee. I wouldn't say angry or aggressive. I know they probably label me as aggressive, but just difficult, because I'm going to ask you why. If I'm not feeling anything, I'm not going to, at this point, I don't really sugarcoat. I am who I am. But what I've been able to do through all, it can be any small thing, like you putting your hat down too strong, or you have a strong, it could be any and every little microaggression. So I don't even know what's a different examples. It could be any fucking thing. I could be just breathing and it's something, why are you breathing too hard? But I think the thing that has given me grace through all this is, again, having the connection with these brothers here, going to a therapist, working out has actually been really good. Trying to use some of the stuff that I impart with those that I support in their healing journey. So maybe am I doing some meditation in the park? Am I doing my own yoga? Am I reading certain books, right? And also an EAP, employee assistance person or whatever, invest in them, because I've had to invest in one past almost year and a half, 2 years. They come in handy, because if something goes on, you have something on file that you've met with them. And also, I don't want to get too much into it later, if there's some stuff that's going on, take some time off, some FMLA, time off from work, and document what's been going on. Because if you put that and let it be known, if you need to sue or you need something to settle out of court, you got that to back you up. So it's a holistic approach to help me as an African American dealing with anti-blackness in this field.
This question is kind of related, y'all. As a social worker who's a person of color serving other people of color while operating under white leadership or white supremacy, How do you or can you effectively advocate and support your clients / community that you serve at your workplace?
I mean, it's the responsibility of us to like do that. And so I'm wondering if the question is actually speaking to like doing that in a way that doesn't jeopardize your employment.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like there's any conflict that arises there in having like, I mean, I know some of y'all have had white supervisors, like what comes up in that dynamic in terms of like how you're approaching the work and like, how do you still continue to effectively advocate? And are there ways in which like whiteness and white people in power like impede that?
I have been fortunate to work with any white supervisor that I've had has been effectively engaging in decolonizing work. So being highly cognizant of how they show up in different spaces and thinking about their position of power and how it impacts not only the organization that we work with, but also the people that we're serving. That's been a blessing, I think, like I've had doing this work, because that's not always the case. And that's where problems arise, because I've been comfortable presenting a problem or an issue to my supervisors, like this is what I'm hearing from the person I'm working with, and I could use some support about how to alleviate it or think differently about this. And it's been met effectively. And so I can't really speak on an experience where it was like my white supervisor was falling short due to a lack of knowledge or readiness to like think differently about like systemic problems or problems that the client was coming up with. I think that's, and so to kind of bring it home, like that's important to be aware of. If you have a white supervisor, it doesn't mean that they'll be ineffective. It doesn't mean that they won't be able to meet your needs. If they're engaging in this decolonizing their mentality and social power, like that, you can actually do a lot of meaningful work with someone who's a superior like that. Also, feel free to push back on what the fuck I just said.
Yo, so I mean, in my process of getting licensed, it's been interesting. So I've been practicing now for about 4 years. And in that time, I've had about 5 different supervisors, and some of them being like non-Black women of color, and the majority of them being white women. And like, I've had the whole spectrum. Like my supervisor right now is cool. I really feel supported by her. But I feel like I've had to like come into that space and be very apprehensive. Like when I first came out of grad school and I walked into my first job, I like felt like I cannot allow all pieces of myself to come into this room. Like I feel like there was like this sense that I had to like justify my existence in the space, especially coming onto a team where I'm one of the only few folks of color. And I think like over the years, I've just allowed myself to accept that like I've gotten to a point where I'm gonna be myself to my full extent in every fucking meeting. I'm gonna say and call out white supremacy on a daily basis, regardless of who that is, if it's my supervisor or anyone else, because like, especially being like a non-Black person of color in the space, being cis, being het, I have so much privilege that is definitely like my responsibility to leverage that. And so there's certain shit that like I'll get away with and I can say and I can call out in this space that like my coworkers who are Black women don't have the same luxuries and privileges. And so it's like I have to ride harder, not just for myself and the own like the experiences of racism that I have in that space, but for my coworkers that are experiencing anti-Blackness, for my coworkers that are queer or trans or whatever it is, whatever marginalized identity is being oppressed in that workspace. Like I just have to remind myself that it's like, okay, I have to like decenter myself and like remember like why did I come to this work? And so I think it goes for my coworkers as well as it goes for the young people. Like at some point, you're going to hit some point in your work where someone, you know, your boss or whoever it is not going to be down with whatever it is that you're coming with, whether it's an intervention or, you know, like y'all are trying to move forward on like a case or a placement or whatever it is. And y'all have like some type of ideological difference. You're going to continually face these decisional points where you have to, you know, decide like what is more important. Because you may get to a point where disagreeing with that person could cost you your job. or calling someone out on the ways in which that they've been sexist or homophobic or white supremacist within the work, that shit could cost you your job. And we're constantly playing, like, you know, weighing these decisions on almost a daily basis in terms of how we show up in the space, how strictly are we adhering to our values in the work, and what shit do we just have to let slide? Because ultimately, like, the shit is a marathon, it's not a sprint. And we're here to do this good work, and we're here doing it for these communities that, like, we're from. And so it's important that we continue to sustain ourselves and continue to be in this work, but it just can't come at the cost of, like, compromising our values entirely.
I feel like, too, when it comes to clients and advocating for clients, it could be difficult, especially when you're having, like, group supervisions or kind of group consultations and things like that. And I think that it's important in those spaces that we do speak up. Mm-hmm. There's a quick example that I've had is that there was at the Anti-Violence Partnership, there was a guy with doctor in psychology, and he ran these group supervisions, and a social worker was working at a high school, and she was saying this, you know, she was a white woman, and the child she was speaking about was a ninth grade black boy. And she was saying, you know, he just doesn't want to talk to me. He doesn't open up. I don't know what else to do. And the guy and the doctor was just like, he's like, well, you know, you can't really do much else. So, like, give it two more sessions and then just, like, end with them. And so in that moment, I'm just like, well, wait, like, this is a 13, 14 year old black boy. You're a white woman. He automatically is going to say, is seeing that, because it's probably making that assumption that y'all have nothing in common. So maybe you need to do that work, like, figure out what he likes. If he likes basketball, start watching ESPN. If he likes Lil Wayne, start listening to some of the music to make that connection. Because if he feels like he doesn't like you at all, he doesn't know you, then of course he's not going to open up. He doesn't trust you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just pushing coworkers and colleagues to think a little bit differently, to think from a person of color's point of view rather than as therapists that's here to help, and I don't know why they're rejecting our services. Like, think of it from the point of view of the client. Like, what all is going on with them? Who do we represent? What does a white face versus a black face represent to them? And speaking up in those larger settings, even if there's supervisors or directors or anything like that, I think it's always important to say, well, what if we think about it this way? Or what if we look at it this way? And sometimes it's scary being that one voice when the other 10 are like, nah, drop them. But I think that, you know, that's our job. You know, as social workers, that's our job. We advocate. We, when everyone else is going left, we like, no, let's try right. You know, so yes, a little bit to add to that.
For sure. Appreciate that, man. Yeah. And I think especially when it comes to, like, the folks that we serve, like, for me, that's young people and their families. If I know they need something and I can support them in making that happen, and that's not in line with, like, I don't know, whatever, what the supervisor wants or the mission of our work, I'm definitely the type, like, I'm just going to ask for forgiveness. I'm not going to ask for permission. Like, if I know this is something that someone needs and I can support them in making that happen, I'm going to do it, and then I'll deal with that later. But yeah. But yeah, Jeremy asked, how do you all deal with quote unquote failures or notions of not fulfilling your job as intended within your client relationships?
Woo.
I read that question.
Fantastic question.
I learned about self-compassion, and that is going to be necessary for social workers. That's necessary for everybody. And I think as social workers, I mean, you'll know when it's like, damn, this isn't sitting right with me. And I think self-compassion is a good practice, because the work's going to be there waiting for you tomorrow. It's going to be there the next day. And it's unrealistic to think that you can solve all of the issues and challenges that someone you're working with is experiencing in a 24-hour period. And sometimes in order to do this work, you got to make sure you're filling yourself up, and that's okay. So that's where that self-compassion piece comes in. It's like, okay, in order for me to meet the needs of the people who I'm working with, who I feel like I didn't meet those needs fully today, I got to set, I got to reset, I got to recharge, and it's going to be waiting for me tomorrow. And that's okay. That's it's like how you frame it. I think that can be a big piece, because you frame it as an opportunity, like you get to do it again. I'm speaking from personal experience. That's what's helped me. And I'll also just normalize, like, you're going to have the feeling like that you fell short.
I mean, I think, like, we tend to be our biggest critic. You know what I mean? Like, we put so much pressure on ourselves that we would never put on anyone else. You know, like, if we're working with a young person and they're coming up short on a goal that they set, we're not going to view them as a failure. You know what I mean? We're going to acknowledge the small steps that they took, the progress that they made. Even if they came up short, they still did something there. You know what I mean? But, like, I think it's a lot harder for us, because of whatever reason, like how we ended up in this space, to hold that same level of, like, insight and perspective for ourselves, where, you know, like, where are these external assumptions or judgments around what is a failure and what is success? You know what I mean? Because the work that we do is relational. It's about building a safe space. It's about building community. So regardless of whatever the paperwork says, with the treatment plan, any of that stuff, if you build a real and authentic connection with someone, that's a success. Mm-hmm. And that could have a lasting impact on someone's life, regardless of how long you're involved in this person's life, that they, that you were there to help walk them through some of the most difficult shit. Even if, like, they didn't get to where they wanted to or they intended to, that they were there. And that's something to build off of. But yeah, I think we have to allow ourselves to let go of some of that unreasonable judgment that we hold, because the reality is we'll end up wearing ourselves out of a job, and we would never put those types of expectations on any of our coworkers or any of the people that we serve. And so we deserve just as much love in that space. You know what I mean?
I think my tidbits of that would be, as long as you're doing your best, for one, right? As long as you've tried what you can do, your best effort, that's one thing. Another thing is, were you able to get supervision on why you failed? This is a failure. And I mean, failure is a relative word. Like, it can mean different things to different people. Also, wherever you're at, like, if there's some type of mission to your job or whatever the purpose of your job is, like, look up that job mission for that role and see if you try executing it as much as you possibly could. And of course, you're gonna have your days where it may not feel the best, because you're human too. But similar to what Mike was saying, just to have compassion with yourself. And also notice, like, if you have people who've been doing social work for decades, not every person you come across is going to be somebody that is something that is going to be this thing. Like, that's not going to be the case. There's going to be some people where you know, it's never there. It's never the onus is on them. But I think just in general, just take that as a learning opportunity. And that's a lot of pressure to put in yourself for every client. Like, I've been in the field for like 5 years, and I think overall I give myself like a B, a middle, like an 85, you know, I got that's 15 points. I'm 15 points short of 100. Cause you know, even, Michael Jordan missed shots, Steph Curry missed shots, you throw interceptions and it's going to be okay. You just take that as an opportunity to not get your head down too much and just use that for the next time to be better for that next client.
Josh, you a harsh critic of yourself, man. You're probably hella dope, 100%. Got it going on. I will say one way that you can sort of tell how much a client is feeling the work that you're doing is if they come back. I think that's the way that I've been able to assess, like, is the person getting anything out of what we're doing? And when they keep coming back, I'm like, okay, maybe so.
I think just really quickly, it takes that village too, because this field is a thankless job. People will not say thank you. people will say thank you, but like, not to the extent that we deserve overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. And so I really think you have to really have this village that you can share things with, that can kind of talk you through and like really point out like well, you didn't do that, but you did that, and that. So, like, that's dope as hell. They would have never gotten that if you hadn't helped them, right? And similar to what Mike was saying, like, I think a lot of, in therapy for me, too, it was just like, am I doing this right? Like, am I fucking this kid up more? But, you know, if they keep coming back, whether it's kids, adults, whoever, then they're getting something from it. Even just sitting with kids, I know, typically are just always being told what to do and what they can't do. So just holding space for like a 5-year-old in a session is really powerful. Whether or not you're playing checkers or whatever, like it can be really powerful for that kid.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Kamaria asked, any tips/words of advice for taking the LMSW exam?
I commented pocket prep.
For sure.
I took exams all day on that thing. And it was helpful because they provide an explanation for why an answer is the correct one. And it gives insight into what the exam might be looking for. And I'm a notorious bad test taker. Standardized tests, can't do them. Have never done well. But I did pass my licensing exam on the first time. And I also studied my ass off. And I use pocket prep to help.
For my California folks, I had to take both the law and ethics exam and the LCSW, the ASWB clinical exam, whatever it is. For both of those, I did the Therapist Development Center. So all the folks that I work with, they also did Therapist Development Center. It's a little pricey. I think the LCSW prep exam was probably like $250. And the LCSW exam prep was probably the same. But I passed both those on the first go. So I highly, highly recommend it, because the reality is you could be the most amazing social worker in the field and still go in and fail that test. Mm-hmm. Because their perception of what is like ethical or the right thing in the moment is still inherently biased by the white lens of the folks that wrote the test. Yes. So you're gonna know, like, if you study well, you'll know what the right answer is, but you'll still have like a visceral reaction to it and be like, oh, that's not what I do, but I know this is what you're looking for. So, you know, for anyone that goes in and doesn't pass the test on the first go, like, that's also another point of like, there's got to be some acceptance around that. You know what I mean? Like, ultimately, we're operating in a space in a field that was not initially intended for us. And so the tests and like the examinations and the licensure process is reflective of, you know, not necessarily opening up or providing space for us. It's intentionally keeping some of us out of that space. And so if it doesn't go well the first go, like, allow yourself some grace and acknowledge that, like, that's just racist and fuck that test.
Yes.
I was gonna say, don't overstudy. Like, study enough, but don't overdo it. And I mean, still have fun, live your life, like, have a study schedule, but make sure everything else in your life is, you know, you're talking to your family, you're working out, eating your fruits and vegetables or your ice cream, whatever the case may be. Still trying to live your life and be who you are. And don't overstudy. And also get a good, not to sound cliche, get a good night's sleep before the test and eat a breakfast or whatever the case may be, but the shit is true.
I love how cliche turns into like whiteness.
out here in Philly, they have the, like, usually it's universities that host like day long trainings for the test. So they usually cost anywhere between like $80 and $100. So I know out here in Philly, Temple University has one, University of Pennsylvania has one, and I have not taken it. I will take it in the future because I did not pass my LCSW test the first time, which was difficult, but I'm ready for it again. So, like, these, I hear really good things about these 8-hour training sessions, but they go really in detail with the questions and explanations and how to, and they teach you how to answer the questions, even if you have no idea, you know, what any of the choices are. They kind of give you the deductive reasoning or whatever the hell, so you can answer it the best way that you can.
Yeah. And I mean, I think as you're like exiting school too, like it's important to think about the licensure piece and like whether you want to get licensed and like what the intention is of getting licensed. Cause you could be a functioning social worker out here in the world with never getting a license. It's not mandatory in terms of like you and your work. And so it's like, what is the intention of getting the license and what do you plan on doing that? And also like asking folks as you start to interview for jobs, is your workspace going to support you with that? Because I've known plenty of people who got out of grad school, got into their first job and weren't even receiving supervision. So, you know, that was one thing where I've never had to worry about that. I've always had a supervisor since I got out of grad school. My job paid for me to take all the necessary classes that I needed to do to get the additional CEUs I needed. They paid for all these study courses. They paid for my exam registration. So these are things to ask your employer too, as you're getting out of social work, is like, how invested are they in making sure that all their clinicians are licensed and what are they going to do to support you with that?
Mm-hmm. I want to expand upon something Jesse said about not necessarily needing a license to be a functional social worker. And I think that's 100% true. And I think that depending on your location, there are certain opportunities that will not present themselves unless you have a license. And I speak from my personal experience of not being able to get a job that I was interested in without having a license. And because of our current capitalist system, the jobs that typically pay more for the folks in social work are for folks who have their independent clinical license. But again, having that clinical license doesn't necessarily mean you're a good social worker. It means you know how to take exams and you've been doing this work for X amount of years.
Mm-hmm. Chanel asked, what are the biggest changes you feel social work as a profession needs to make in order to better provide for and understand our clients of color? How do we stop seeing social work through a white only lens?
Put Black women in leadership positions.
And give them the support and the trainings and the money. And don't give them the organization when it's about to go be a shit show.
Yeah.
My initial reaction is like, put some respect on a social worker's name. Like, we do ground level work. We do hard work. And I don't know if it's a stigma. It might still be a stigma associated with social work or possibly several other factors. But like, I don't know. I feel like, one, they don't pay us enough. And that's, I mean, I'm sure y'all have seen the resources being circulated about how much police are making in your communities. Like, damn, it's fucked up. Paying people a lot to terrorize communities as opposed to promoting the culture of well-being. So that needs a shift. That needs a change. And I think part of the stigma too, like, maybe there's not more like Black men in social work because there's a stigma of like talking about mental health or exploring mental health. So that needs to shift as well.
I mean, I think we need change at like every single level. Like when thinking about higher education and our collective experience at Boston College, I think like they were ill-equipped to engage in conversations around race, the large majority of our professors. The fact that they can create some type of coursework that is like focused on diversity, and that's a one semester course and that's it. Like if conversations around like race, decolonization, liberation is not critically interwoven into every single class session of every single class, like it's good that bias is gonna continue to be there. And even within the field of social work, considering how dominated it is by white women, like we also have to unpack the patriarchy there, because so many schools of social work are led by white men. A large majority of the professors are white men. And it's also the same at a lot of these like, you know, government organizations or nonprofits. Like a lot of times that shit is led by white men and they're the biggest problem. So it's like, yeah, folks can like, you know, quit their job and give that shit to a Black woman. I think that's it. But, you know, there's a bunch of tweets going around right now just about like the current state of the world and anti-Black racism in the world. And there's one that I particularly appreciate, and it's, your DEI training is not going to be the revolution. Right. Like, I think the idea that we have to hold these trainings within our organizations, our institutions, to kind of get people on board with acknowledging people's humanity is all types of fucked up. Like, those people don't need to be in the work first and foremost. And that's only going to happen when we get people in positions of leadership that reflect us, that reflect the community, that will start to form things that are actually reflective of our values of liberation, of anti-oppression. And sometimes that might not happen at your work. And I think that was a big part of like us starting Melanated Social Work, where we were just like, yo, this is something we can do ourselves. This is something that we feel like we have control over, and we control the messaging around that. And I think in some situations, that's the only way we get there, is when we start to do our own shit.
I was just going to say real quick, and yes, I'm going to say real quick, this stuff isn't really going to happen until white people reconcile more so with the racism that they've started as the foundations for social work, right? I think before we got on this call, we were saying, like, you know, in Germany, they apologized and showed different efforts to apologize for the Holocaust to the Jews. That's never happened to African Americans by anybody in government like that ever. And I think also real quick, the one thing that withholds all these things, oh, it's not like for the people of color and Black people that's here, keep listening to Melanated Social Work. Get our merch. You know what it is. But for the white people, y'all gotta hold each other accountable, man. You know, we hold each other accountable. We hold people in our affinity groups accountable. But white people don't hold each other accountable, because if they did, they wouldn't have voted majority like they did to Trump. And they're the ones that are, they put Black Lives Matter and all this stuff, the representational gestures. But when it's coming time to, when they need to speak up to HR, or that one very MAGA-like passive aggressive covert racist person at work, they don't say anything. And until they keep each other accountable, none of this shit's gonna really matter. So at the end of the day, it's all about us. Like, we can do our own thing, you know, we could, you know, have our own communities, our own affinity groups, and just like the white people, y'all go do y'all thing. This is our space, this is what we're gonna do. And if you think about it, we're not a minority, because if you think about it, they're the minority on the world. So we just gotta remember, we're not outnumbered, we're out-organized. And Malcolm X said that.
I think y'all said everything. I don't have anything else to
I mean, I'm just re-looking at the question in terms of, like, what do we need to make better, provide, and understand our clients of color? Like, I operate under the understanding that folks know exactly what it is that they need. I think we, as the providers, oftentimes complicate shit. We come in with a certain agenda of what we think we're there to do. And just because, like, what they need does not fall with under our job title, that we think, like, somehow, like, that's not our responsibility. So even if I'm here to do the therapy, but I'm working with a family that's dealing with this housing crisis that we got going on in the Bay Area, or they don't have access to food, or their light bill just got cut, you know what I mean? Like, I'm there to support people in what they need. And oftentimes people know exactly what they need. And so it's like, we get to choose, as social workers, as providers, like, what we are investing power and weight in. And I'm going to invest that power in the community. Like, you know, I've talked about, like, I've learned more in terms of what does it mean to be an effective social worker through my process of studying critical race theory than I have from reading any, like, fucking Freud or any of that shit. Like, because, I mean, that's so devoid and connected from the community that I work in. And so I think it's really important for folks to be actually connected to community, that we're not dropping in and dropping out of a space, that we are actually tied to this community. And I think that's how you actually start to provide better services, that it goes beyond just your 9-to-5 job, that we are social agents of change, and we need to be supporting the liberation of specifically Black and Indigenous folks all the time. And that goes beyond work. And, you know, we have to be addressing that in multiple different facets. But I think we get a better sense of, like, how do we better support folks of color when we're actually a part of community with the folks of color that we serve.
I'm gonna add on quickly to the last part of the question that says, how do we stop seeing social work through a white only lens? For the social workers who identify as a social worker of color, trust the lens that you bring into the field and trust yourself. I think a lot of times we have to negotiate the feelings of, like, imposter syndrome. Like, am I going to be taken seriously? Is this going to land with people if I say something? I may not even have the language to say that I'm thinking differently about this, but, like, just go for it and trust that what you're going to say and bring is what's needed. Because, like, you're the lens that's the non-white that the space needs.
Yeah. And people are hungry for that shit. Like, just know that even if you're someone who hasn't even started social work school, or you're a person of color who just finished social work school, just know that you bring so much intrinsic knowledge to the work just by being a person of color. And that shit is hella valuable. And your veteran white counterpart social workers can never match that shit, because that is just inherently you and your experience and your identity of where you came from. And people want to hear about that shit. Like, real talk, when we started this venture and we were like, oh yeah, we're going to start a podcast. And I was legit thinking, like, hey y'all, if we get 50 streams on the podcast total, like, yeah, that shit would be lit. Like, and you know what I mean? Like, over a year later, we have over like 30,000 streams. So it was just like, we were definitely by any means not experts in what we do, but we were just coming from this real perspective of, like, we're folks of color and we feel like people need to talk more about what it's like to be a person of color in this work. And people started to listen. And so it's like, in the same manner, if you're a person of color doing this work, like, just sharing your experiences, like, that shit is powerful, because you have no idea how that could influence another person of color that is alongside you in the workspace, or just someone else. Like it holds a lot of power. And like, we need to amplify and share our experiences in the work, so people know that, like, there are people that look like us. You know what I mean?
I just wanted to add, because I know that there are some recent grads here around interviewing and, like, negotiating your salary, which sounds very scary. But similar to what Jesse was saying, like, you're hella valuable in that space. And they chose you to send you, like, an offer letter or whatever for a reason. And what I found in my last job with the district, because with the district, you could see everyone's salaries. And so clinicians of color, social workers of color, saw that on average, all of the white social workers were getting paid, I want to say 2,000 to 3,000 more than the social workers of color. And so always make sure that you negotiate your salary. Always make sure, and it can, you can be new, you can be non-licensed yet, negotiate your salary.
Mm-hmm. Never accept the first offer. Yeah. Never accept the first offer.
Yeah. There are resources, you know, if you need help with how to negotiate or just, like, wording, practice it, especially if it's like a larger organization or like a hospital or like a school district or university. Those, they got money. Mm-hmm. Do not think you're asking for too much. They have the money.
Yeah.
And also ask, I mean, something that Kalida told me was that, you know, we are so, talking about salary is so taboo because that's another way that we can oppress people.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's the reason why it's like, oh, we can't talk about salary. I openly talk about how much I made and all of my jobs. Yep. Because that's how much you should be making. Or no, fuck that. You should be making more than whatever the fuck. Yep. I made.
That's right. Yeah. Go ahead, bro.
I bet. Real quick, all I'm going to say is also, if you're able to speak more languages, add that more for your value, but also don't let them overwork you as well, because there's some people who out there who may be able to speak, I say in Boston, Spanish, Haitian Creole, Cape Verdean Creole. they're going to try to make you do so much, maybe more outside of your job description that you're not getting paid for. Mm-hmm. So I would just say, like,
that part,
negotiate that, negotiate what those things are. And if it's not even money, maybe having, you know, maybe you can work from home on Fridays or get more professional development for yourself. Yep. Or whatever the fuck else, you know, so.
And I think to add to all that, like, that shit goes with grad school too. Negotiate your scholarship. If you got a scholarship, negotiate that shit. Like, when I was at Boston College, I got a job within the admissions department. And this was something that I just never even thought to do. And I would read these emails of these white people asking for more money. And they had less experience than I did. And so ever since then, I've just really tried to tell folks, like, even if you get into a school of social work and they offer you a scholarship, like, leverage that. Tell them that someone else offered you more. And, like, because the reality is you're going to get into school and you're going to be an unpaid professor, because there's going to be certain shit that comes up in the class and everyone's going to look to you for the answers, specifically for the folks of color. So it's like they need to compensate us for that free labor that we continually bring and actually enrich the discussion of their classroom. And it's totally cool to name that and leverage that and tell them that they need to be giving you more money because you're supporting the learning of everyone else. Yeah, Carrie asked, what about when the salary range is on the job posting? Would you still negotiate over the highest number? I mean, shit, like, why not? Like, the worst case scenario, they tell you no and they cap you at the top. But I think, especially for folks of color coming into those conversations, like, we have to be ready to justify, like, why it is. And I think we, in general, as people of color, severely downplay our experience and our expertise. And there's been, like, studies that have shown that white people are just much more likely to apply for jobs that they are underqualified for. And folks of color will actually not apply to a job that they are even qualified for because they worry that they're not qualified. And so we have to stop downplaying our own existence and our experience and actually speak to all the dope shit that we do in that space to justify, like, why they need us. And I would particularly, for my black folks, like, leverage the moment in history that we are in right now. If that organization or that company has put out any type of graphic or any type of, like, video or feel good shit saying, like, we are here to support black lives, we're down with, like, anti-racism, black liberation, then you can tell them to reflect that in the salary. Like, hey, I know this is something that y'all said you have made a stance for on a policy level, interpersonally within your agency. This is how we can support that. That you can bring me in at a salary that's higher than my white counterpart that has equally as much experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Get them coins.
It's all truth.
But yeah, I know we're getting close to the end of time. Did y'all want to just, like, close out with any final thoughts that you have?
Oh, wait, sorry, because somebody sent me questions. I forgot. Ooh, I don't know if you have enough time for these. So one is, are there strategies that you found helpful in protecting clients from police harm when working in social work roles that often involve law enforcement? And then how do you help establish healthy boundaries in your mind surrounding not bringing work home with you?
I would say to the first thing that you said, as much as you can, like, more so now, there's like in Boston, there's like a trauma hotline that I have them. It's open 24 hours, crisis, whatever the case may be. Our big thing now in my job is just using alternative places for any mental health things. And as far as, to answer in short, not coming home with some things, just trying to, like, you know, try to tap into a hobby or interest, or a really big thing is, I mean, maybe some yoga. Personally, that's what I try to do. It's good for your body and your mind, but try to do something physical. Try to do something mental. Journal. Go for a walk. Unplug. Just try to get away from the work as much as you can. And also, don't forget your family. Your family, sometimes, they'll be like, yo, where is this person at? So don't forget about your family. And also, if you have any type of spiritual connection, to tap into that higher being.
Mm.
I'll talk on the second part about how do you not bring homework, how do you not bring work home? Ritual, some type of transition. I have a home outfit. Like, if whatever I wore to work that day, first thing I do when I come home is change clothes. Sometimes I wash my hands, like wash the day off me or take a shower. Like, it looks different for everybody, but like, I have some type of transition, some type of ritual I practice where I'm like, all right, I'm no longer at work. I'm in my home outfit. I'm in a t-shirt and sweats. That's what it is. And I'm like, damn. All right, now I'm at home. I try not to do notes at home. Like, truly, like, I try not to, like, check emails when I'm at home. And, of course, that's hard to negotiate. Like, as a social worker, we often are, like, always tapped in because a crisis could come up and we need to be able to, like, support and advocate for our client. But, like, try not to. And just, I hold in mind that, like, all the work, all the world's issues and graces are going to be waiting for you the next day.
Yeah.
And you want to be charged for it and ready to take on whatever it is. So, like, offer yourself, I like Jeremy's word of grace, offer yourself grace.
Yeah.
And let the day be complete.
Yeah. Yo, so I honestly think if you're a social worker and you've made this commitment to furthering social justice, you have a responsibility locally to get involved in some type of effort or organizing to defund and abolish the police. I mean, like, we saw, you know, Oakland, folks were able to remove police from OPD, which is like a huge step in the right direction. We're looking to decrease the general fund that goes to police in general. Like, we just got to get rid of them. Then we don't have to worry about partnering with them. But even in my work interpersonally with the young folks and the families, I talk about that early on in our experience, because within Alameda County, as a therapist, I cannot put someone on a safety hold. It actually requires having interface with a police officer or a sheriff for a young person to get put on a safety hold if they're a threat to themselves or to someone else. And I talk about that during intake, that the reality is, like, the way that the system is set up right now is fucked up. And we may have to have some type of contact with police, but I talk about with young people, what does it mean to engage with the police and to maintain their safety? Or for families, what does it mean if they call the police because they're having an issue with the child or something like that? As much as possible, I try to create ways to operate outside of utilizing the police. So if a family, if they're dealing with a young person who is a safety risk to themselves or someone else, I'll, as much as possible, try to get that parent to just drive their child directly to a hospital. They can go to a hospital, get assessed by a doctor in an emergency room to get admitted into a crisis stabilization unit. And if, like, you're in Boston and you have access to the best team, or there's, like, different crisis response units, unfortunately in Alameda County, they cut the funding for our crisis response unit. So we no longer have that in our county. But if, for folks that are in the Bay Area, definitely tap in with the dope ass work of the Anti-Police Terror Project. They're actually hosting their first meeting this Saturday to develop a community-led mental health first responder team. And it doesn't require that folks are actually mental health professionals or anything like that. They're just looking to put together community-led teams where folks have some type of mental health crisis that people from the community could actually show up and respond and support, as opposed to having an alternative to calling the police.
Yeah, I would, you know, for my adult clients, when I'm talking safety plans, you know, that first, if someone has to be hospitalized, the first thing you're supposed to do is call the police. Absolutely not. So we develop a safety plan, and we think of at least three people that person can call and that person trusts to take them to, like, crisis or the hospital or whatever, because we know how. We don't know if that person's going to come back if they, you know, are in police custody. I think also is, if you're working with kids, I know I worked in the school, and so, you know, people, maybe the principal or assistant principal says, we have to call the police. I'm like, nope, let me talk to them first. Like, let me try before you do that, let me talk to them. And then if the police have to come, I'm always with that student. And I'm trying to advocate, like, nope, maybe can you not use handcuffs? Can they do this? Can I walk with them over there? Like, use yourself as the professional, so that the young person doesn't have to interact with the police officers, because police are traumatic as fuck for a lot of our clients. just hearing the sirens for a lot of them, right? And so, like, it's up to us to advocate and to use our physical bodies to protect them. And as far as self-care and collective care, Jesse coined that term for me, that I use it all the time now. But I think for me right now, and I agree with what folks have said, but just eating and drinking water and sleeping, like that basic thing for me, I was missing for a long time. And I was like, what is wrong with me? And I was just like, oh, it's 8 p.m. and I didn't eat anything yet. Or I only had 4 hours of sleep. So, you know, making it a point to eat and drink water and sleep. Also therapy. I see my therapist every week and I am looking forward to seeing his ass tomorrow because I got some more to tell him. but yeah, therapy is for me is key. I know a lot of folks who are social workers and our therapists. You're probably that friend that listens to everybody's shit. And I think that some people don't even ask, like, if it's okay. They just jump right on in. And so having, you know, your client stuff and having your friend stuff and your family stuff, and if you have a partner, you know, all of that can be really overwhelming. And so it's nice to have a space where you can, it can be about you, you know, and that you can, you know, really talk about what's going on in your life.
Yeah. Yo, like, on that piece on the work-life balance, just acknowledge that there's never going to be a balance. Like, things are constantly going to be in flux. No, real talk. Like, no one's ever going to get there. Like, we're just going to continually cycle in and out of, like, our own wellness and being stressed and overwhelmed with the work. But just having, like, that level of awareness to acknowledge when that's happening. I think especially during this moment where all of us are being tested in new ways that, like, we've never had to. Like, because of shelter in place, my workspace is now my home, you know what I mean? So like, there's no physical delineation of like, I leave and I go to work and then I come home, which for me was like key to how I kind of turned on and turned off. And so like, I think we have to continue to develop new habits and routines on like, how do we actually take care of ourselves in this moment? And it's okay to feel like you might be coming up short. I think like there's ways in which like the language around self-care forces us to hold guilt if like we are not doing well or we feel like we are not balancing things, that somehow it's our fault, like we're not doing enough. And just acknowledge and accept that like the realities of this work are challenging. They're gonna require us to come with new and innovative ideas every day, that we're not just gonna develop some routine and habit and that's enough. Because as you'll see, like a fucking pandemic will happen and it changes everything. Every aspect of my work has changed. And it's required me to be flexible and rethink like, okay, then how do I actually engage in work? How do I take care of myself? How do I acknowledge like I'm at work and then I'm done with work? But yeah, and just, it's just a process of like you said, just holding grace, being kind with yourself, practicing acceptance. Yeah.
And I'm going to real quick add to that. I would say before y'all go to sleep tonight, write down 3 dope things about yourself that you feel separates you from other people. And keep those things in mind, especially in these times when there's a black uprising across the world that's been going on. Keep those things in mind. Again, go to your therapy. Like I took off next week. I got my therapy session lined up. I have my acupuncture session lined up. I'm gonna be running and doing yoga and doing all types of things. Like, this is one thing I gotta say, take your mental health days and take your time off, because the work will be there, you know. So take the time for yourself, take time off.
Thank you all very, very much for joining us. Thank you for your thoughtful questions. If you have more questions, feel free to email us at melanatedsocialwork@gmail.com. Continue listening to the Melanated Social Work Podcast. If you have not checked that out, please do. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever the hell else you listen to podcasts. Also, Melanated Mindfulness Mondays, every Monday, 7 p.m. Eastern. 4 p.m. I feel like I do this all the time. 4 p.m. Pacific.
That's what's up. That's what's, also, if anybody wants to...
automatically now, huh?
If anyone wants to lead a meditation, to holler at the email.
Also for merchandise, so for the month of June, half of the proceeds are going to organizations that support Black liberation. So we all got, 5 days left for that?
We appreciate y'all so much for being here. You know, we think like having these spaces where we're able to connect with other social workers has been integral to our development. So I'd say if you're entering into grad school, if you're exiting grad school, like find who that cohort of folks is for you at your school. And definitely share like Melanated Social Work as a resource. Like we put out the podcast to hopefully like create space for our voice and our experience in the work, and really for it to be like a tool for learning and education. So, you know what I mean? Share it with your institutions of higher ed, share it with your organizations as you come in to your new job space. But yeah, so hopefully we can help continue to build this network and this knowledge base. So social work isn't so white.
And on that note,
have a good night. Stay safe. Wear your masks. Wear your masks.
Love, everybody.
Yeah. Peace, y'all.
Peace.